Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. It's the 24th of January 2013, and today's interview is with Charles Kalomiris, Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions at Columbia Business School. Professor Kalomiris discusses his recent work that questions what constitutes meaningful bank reform, why it is so necessary, and why it is so unlikely. I began the interview by asking Charles to explain why he is of the opinion that recent international efforts to make banks safer and not meaningful.
I guess the best way to explain it is with some examples from the previous crisis. A reform that would be meaningful would be something that would at least have a chance of preventing what just happened from happening again. So let's look at the U.S., for example. When Citibank was intervened in December 2008, it was widely recognized that it was insolvent or close to insolvent and certainly had lost all the perception in the marketplace of any reliability as a counterparty. It was perceptions like that about Citibank and others that led to the collapse of the interbank market in the liquidity crisis of September 2008. What was Citibank's regulatory capital position as of that date of its collapse and intervention, when the market was believing, according to market capital ratios that you could look at, that Citibank was insolvent? And the answer is, Citibank had a regulatory capital ratio of 11.8%. Now, what has the Basel Committee in particular done with regard to capital standard regulation? It's basically slightly increased capital requirements to the extent that now we can be confident that all banks will be just as safe as Citibank was in December 2008. Of course, that's a joke, because Citibank was insolvent, even though it was showing a book capital ratio for purposes of the Basel regulations of 11.8%, which was far above the minimum and still above the new minimum. So what does this all tell us? It tells us that there was a deeper problem here. It wasn't just that the capital requirement needed to be increased a little. And the deeper problem was that the way risk was being measured and the way capital was being measured were deeply flawed. You can't have a capital ratio regime in which you're trying to measure capital relative to risk and you measure neither one of them. So the problem is that risk needs to be measured on a forward-looking basis accurately. We're not measuring it accurately if we ask bankers or ratings agencies, both of whom are conflicted parties, to measure that risk. And that's, ironically, exactly what we do. I think we are at that level of ridiculousness in the way we conceive of measuring risk. What about measuring capital? Well, there again, capital, when a bank has a loss, the market recognizes the loss, but the accountants don't have to, and the bankers don't have to, and the regulators and supervisors don't have to. And it's the combination of those two things, getting into the crisis, the underestimation of risk, and then once you're in the middle of the crisis, the underestimation of loss, and therefore the underestimation of the need to replace capital, that are at the heart of the regulatory failure. So if that's true, it's obvious that simply tweaking the capital requirements a little bit, just isn't, by a very small increase, isn't going to solve the problem, and it's most obvious when you look at the Citibank case. And then, of course, the liquidity requirements, which were added as a new idea. The other big new idea is to cyclically vary capital requirements. Both of these ideas are good ideas, that is, categorically, we should be doing both. But the problem is, of course, that as soon as the liquidity requirements, which were already deeply politicized and almost beyond recognition of any economics, as soon as it looked like they might even have an effect, they were immediately watered down and then postponed till 2019. In other words, if the bankers don't like the regulation, or if the politicians don't like the regulation gets put off until it doesn't have any binding effect. And that was, I think, almost, again, comical with respect to the recent postponement of the liquidity regulation.
Okay, you mentioned politics there briefly, and you suggest in your work that the new era of banking instability reflects a pervasive change in the politics of banking that will be hard to reverse. What are the politics of banking exactly, and how have those politics become so powerful?
I think that there's a very big misconception about what the key issues are in the politics of banking. Most people look at it as an issue about the political power of big banks. There's no question that there's an issue associated with the political power of large corporations, large banks being part of that. But that is not at the heart of what has gone wrong all over the world. At the heart of what's gone wrong is that the political process is so myopic that borrowers and depositors cannot suffer politically, are not willing to suffer, and have the ability to prevent themselves from suffering the normal cyclical costs that come with recessions, from the standpoint of depositor loss, potentially, or the reduction of credit. In other words, we've gotten to the point where in societies all over the globe, the notion that a depositor could lose a dollar is completely off the table in almost all countries. Furthermore, the notion that a credit crunch could happen, as is normal during a recession, when banks lose money, as they must during a recession, as their loan portfolio loses value, banks that are prudent have to contract credit. Well, that's not popular, and it's especially not popular prior to elections. So the research has shown that when you look at country after country since, let's say, the 1970s, there's been a widespread and unprecedented adoption of measures to protect banks so that we can prevent contractions of credit supply in the short run, or losses to depositors. This is an unprecedented, a completely new political shift. If we go back to the 1940s or the 1950s or any time prior to that, the protection that was offered to banks was very selective, only a few countries, only a few episodes. What used to be the exception has now become the rule. If you're going to protect banks, that means you're protecting them from market discipline. That means that you're insuring their deposits, you're having central banks bail them out right and left, or governments. And if that's true, there is no discipline on their risk-taking, because the whole point of protecting them is to remove that discipline. If you're going to do that, which is a political choice, then you have to substitute some kind of regulatory regime that's effective. But of course, if the whole point of protecting them was to make it possible for them to continue to imprudently extend credit during the recession, or to protect depositors from loss so that you remove any disciplinary withdrawal of deposits from banks that are acting imprudently, then it's naive to expect that regulators are now going to step into the breach and do precisely what the politicians don't want them to do, which is to cause a credit crunch or to fail to protect our banks.
So what does current research tell us about how banks can best increase their lending whilst at the same time ensuring that they comply with stricter regulatory standards? Some would perceive there to be an inherent contradiction in there.
Yeah, I think there is an inherent contradiction. In other words, right now, of course, you're seeing this a little bit in the UK. You're seeing strong efforts by the government in coordination with the Bank of England to encourage banks to lend. But at the same time, you're seeing the government, quite rightly, I think, in, I would say, the UK and Switzerland are the two most serious countries about reform, precisely because their financial systems are so large relative to GDP that they can't really afford, even myopic politicians can't afford to keep allowing the system to blow up. And so you could see the tension that you described very much in the UK's attempts to increase the supply of credit, to try to encourage banks to do it, but at the same time, making it very clear to the banks that there are serious reforms underway and they're not done yet. So how does a bank increase its lending without increasing its risk? Not so easy, and I'd say pretty much impossible. And then if you're telling a bank that you want it to increase its equity capital while you're asking it to increase its lending, that is, its equity capital ratio, well, that's very hard, because raising capital is costly. Debt financing is less costly than equity financing, not just because of risk, but because of a lot of other things, taxes being one of them. But that's even not the most important one, I would say. The most important one is that you have to convince people to supply the equity when you raise it in the market, and they're very concerned that there may be things about your bank that they don't know that will lead to unexpected loss. And so conveying information to would-be equity purchasers is very costly. So the key problem is, yes, sure, you would think, well, why can't we have more lending and higher capital ratios, just get the banks to lend more and raise even more equity capital in the market? In some physical sense, of course, you could have it both ways. But the problem is, it's very costly for banks to do that. And so there really is a choice between wanting to have a more prudent banking system and wanting to have a banking system that's increasing its lending during a tough time in the economy.
So what do you consider to be the keys to ensuring more effective prudential regulatory reform, very briefly?
Well, of course, the most fundamental key is that you have to get the political will to do it. Because the first issue is, are you going to actually have supervisors and regulators and politicians that want to solve this problem? Because I think they recognize that they may not want to. Now, if they do want to solve it, then you have to change the incentives of the two parties that are in charge of the current system, the supervisors on the one hand and the bankers on the other. We have to have rules that measure risk and measure capital credibly. And that means we have to take the measurement out of the discretionary hands of bankers and supervisors. To do that, we have to create much simpler rules, and rules that cannot be gamed. Rules that are so simple and so resilient, that is, robust to any attempt to game, that we can create real accountability, that people can actually see whether the bankers and the regulators are complying with the simple rules that they've established for bankers with respect to capital ratios and cash ratios and the like. So I think the answer is simplicity is the key. Removing discretionary judgments by bankers and by supervisors about capital and about what liquidity means, and creating much simpler sorts of notions of measuring risk, measuring capital, measuring cash. This is completely feasible. It has not been done. And in my view, that's the key problem that needs to be overcome.
So finally, Charles, in a nutshell, are you optimistic about the potential for meaningful reform?
In some countries. I think that I mentioned the UK and Switzerland are two countries that, because they have large financial systems where it's so important to the strategies of their economies that they maintain global linkages and large global universal banks, that they have to solve this problem. That's a little bit like the stories that we've seen in some Latin American and Asian countries, where they've pursued deep reforms politically because they've recognized that their long-term growth strategy and even their short-term ability to continue growing is dependent upon reform. So you could tell that story about Chile, to some extent about Brazil, Mexico, Colombia. There are a lot of good stories to be had. On the other hand, countries like the U.S., Germany, France, and Japan, I don't really see much of political will to fix the problem. And I think that the more likely outcome is that it won't be fixed. And since those countries dominate the Basel system, I don't see much hope that the Basel Committee is going to be getting on reform bandwagon anytime too soon.
Charles Kalamiris, thanks very much.
Thank you.